Then the scene changed. In boarding school, I was very successful. I felt secure with grandfather's liberal allowance and with the love and respect of my schoolmates. I was somebody, substantial and real, and life lacked only one ingredient, romance. Then came the minister's daughter, and in spite of my awkward adolescence, things were complete. I had romance, security, and applause. I was ecstatically happy. Then one morning, the school principal appeared with a sad face and announced that my girl had died suddenly the night before. I dropped into a depression that lasted for 3 solid years. I did not graduate from school. I was unable to finish because I could not accept the loss of any part of what I thought belonged to me. The healthy kid would have felt badly, but he would never have sunk so deep or stayed submerged for so long. Then along came Lois, and I was suddenly alive again, a going concern once more. We married during the World War when I was a young officer at New Bedford. There we were projected among the society folk of the town. For the first time in my life, I saw a butler. Again came that terrible feeling of inadequacy, that shy inability to speak more than 2 or 3 words in a row. It was overwhelming. But one night, someone handed me a Bronx cocktail. Liquor had killed off a lot of my relatives, and I had been repeatedly warned against it. Still, I took this first drink, and then another, and another. Ah, what magic! I had found the elixir of life. Down went that strange barrier that had always stood between me and people around me. My new companions drew nearer to me, and I drew near to them. I was part of life at last. I could talk easily. I could communicate. Here was the missing link. When the war was over, I returned from France, and Lois and I lived in the city. I, the former officer, had to go to work as a clerk, but that only spurred the same old power drive. Although I was only a clerk for the New York Central Railroad, I set my sights to become president of a steel corporation. When the railroad fired me because I was such a bad clerk, I vowed I would show that railroad and everybody else, too. Finally, I got into Wall Street, that famous shortcut to wealth and power, or poverty. In a few years' time, I made far too much money for one so young. I was not disturbed about my drinking, although Lois had become increasingly concerned. In this period, I was drinking to dream great dreams of greater power. I wanted to be a director of many large enterprises. Indeed, I was on the point of realizing my ambitions at the time of the 1929 crash when everything melted away. Although I had gone many thousands of dollars into debt, my arrogance was supreme. I looked with disgust upon the bankrupt people who were then jumping from the high buildings. I said and believed, I can build all this up once more. I've done it once. I can do it again. But I did not do it again. My alcoholic obsession had already condemned me. I no longer had the capacity to hold even the first rung on any comeback ladder. So I began sinking. I could not get a toehold anymore and became a hanger-on in Wall Street. Without money or sobriety, I was discredited everywhere. People knew all too well what I was becoming. Finally, I slid down into a state where I was not drinking to dream dreams of power. I was drinking to numb the pain, to forget. All at once, at the very bottom of the depression, there came a business opportunity that might have meant millions for Lois and me. But I had to sign a contract which bound me legally not to drink. During the life of the agreement, which might be long, I committed myself not to drink at all. This opportunity was colossal from any Wall Street point of view. I said to myself, I'll soon have Lois out of that department store where she's supporting me, make more money than I ever did. This time we are really going to arrive. We Vermonters set great store by our contracts. I really meant to keep my agreement. And for 2 or 3 months, I did stay absolutely sober. The new business operation began, and I went on a trip to look over an industry. One night, a few engineers and I were sitting in a hotel room. They produced a jug. With great relief, I found that I could easily say no. I could think of my contract. I could think of Lois. But as the evening wore on, I began to be bored. The jug kept going around, and finally someone said, "Bill, this is Applejack, Jersey Lightning. Better have one." I suddenly realized that in all my drinking career, I had never had any Jersey Lightning. I said, "Boys, one little shot won't hurt me." Inexplicably, both Lois and my business promise faded. I could think only of the Applejack. In that moment, my insane obsession seized me once again. There followed 3 days of complete oblivion. Then my new business partners called me on the phone and told me that the deal was off. And now I really began to lose hope. My mental disintegration proceeded rapidly and implacably. Soon I was in a hospital, the first of many such cures during the next 2 years. But it wasn't until that fateful night in September 1934 that Lois and I learned from the doctor what my score really was. After leaving the hospital in that month, I kept sober for a while on stark fear and constant vigilance. November came, and I still had not had a drink. This was unheard of. The fear of getting drunk was getting hazier now. I did not have to exert myself so much to resist. I actually began to talk to people about alcoholism. When I was offered drinks, I would volunteer the information I had acquired about the nature of my disease. I found this a defense against taking anything and also a justification for my former condition. Confidence was beginning to grow fast, and my fear left me. Somehow I managed to pick up a few dollars. Perhaps I was not such a serious case after all. I was proving I could stop. I had learned how. Armistice Day 1934 rolled around. Lois had to go to the Brooklyn department store where she worked. Wall Street was closed down, and I began to wonder what I would do. I thought of golf. I had not played in a long time. The family purse was slender, so I suggested to Lois that I might go over to Staten Island, where there was a public course. She could not quite conceal her apprehension, but she managed to say cheerfully, "Oh, please do. That would be wonderful." I crossed on the ferry and took a bus. I found myself seated beside a man with a target rifle. That brought back memories of the Remington single-shot piece Grandfather had given me when I was 11 years old. We got to talking about shooting. Suddenly, our bus collided with the bus ahead of us. There was little shock or damage. My friend and I alighted on the pavement to wait for the next bus to come along, still talking about shooting irons. We noticed something that looked like a speakeasy. He said to me, "What about a little nip?" I said, "Fine, let's go." We walked into the place. He ordered a scotch, and I ordered a ginger ale. "Don't you drink?" he said. "No," I said. "I'm one of those people who can't manage it." And then I dwelt on the allergy and the obsession and the whole business of alcoholism. I told him about the terrible time I had had with liquor and how I was through with it forever. I carefully explained the whole illness to him. We got onto another bus and presently found ourselves in front of a country inn, well down on the island. I was to go to the golf course nearby, and my new friend was to take another bus to his rifle range. But it was noontime, and he said, "Let's go in and have a sandwich. Besides, I'd like to have another drink." We sat at the bar this time. As I have said, it was Armistice Day. The place was filling up, and so were the customers. There was the familiar buzz which arises from drinking crowds. My friend and I continued to talk, still on the subject of shooting. Sandwiches and another drink for him. Sandwiches and ginger ale for me. My mind turned again to Armistice Day in France, to all the joy of those hours, to the great celebration. I no longer heard what my friend was saying. Suddenly, the big Irish bartender came up to us, beaming. In each hand, he held a drink. "Have one on the house, boys," he cried. "It's Armistice Day." Without an instant's hesitation, I picked up the liquor and drank it. My friend looked at me aghast. "My God," he cried, "is it possible that you can take a drink after what you just told me? You must be crazy." And my reply was, "I am." The next morning, about 5 o'clock, Lois found me unconscious in the areaway of our house. I had fallen against the iron grating and was bleeding from a bad scalp wound. My hand still clutched the strap of my golf bag. When I regained consciousness, nothing much was said. Indeed, there was nothing much to say. We both hit an all-time low. I went back to drinking. 1, 2, 3 bottles of bathtub gin a day. I could not stop, and I knew it. Then one afternoon the telephone rang. It was my old boarding school friend and drinking companion, Ebby. Even over the phone, I somehow knew that he was sober. I could not remember a time when he had been sober in New York City. Long ago, I had marked him for a hopeless case. I had heard, in fact, that they were going to put him away because of alcoholic insanity. Eagerly, I said, "Come right on over. We'll talk about the good old days." Now, why did I say that? It was because my present was unbearable, and I knew there was to be no future. Soon, Ebby stood beaming in the doorway. Then he was sitting across the kitchen from me. There was a big crock of gin and pineapple juice between us. Immediately, I felt that there was something different about Ebby. It was not only that he was sober. I could not put a finger on what it was. I offered him a drink, and he refused. Then I asked him, "What's this all about? You say you aren't drinking, but you also say you aren't on the water wagon either. What's up?" "Well," said Ebby, "I've got religion." What a crusher that was. Ebby and religion. Maybe his alcoholic insanity had become religious insanity. It was an awful letdown. I had been educated at a wonderful engineering college where somehow I had gathered the impression that man was God. But I had to be polite, so I said, "What brand of religion have you got, Ebby?" "Oh," he said, "I don't think it has got any special brand name. I just fell in with a group of people, the Oxford groups. I don't go along with all their teachings by any means. But those folks have given me some wonderful ideas. I learned that I had to admit I was licked. I learned that I ought to take stock of myself and confess my defects to another person in confidence. I learned that I needed to make restitution for the harm I had done others. I was told that I ought to practice the kind of giving that has no price tag on it, the giving of yourself to somebody. Now," he added, "I know you're going to gag on this, me that I should try to pray to whatever God I thought there was for the power to carry out these simple precepts. And if I did not believe there was any God, then I had better try the experiment of praying to whatever God there might be. And you know, Bill, it's a queer thing, but even before I had done all this, just as soon as I decided that I would try with an open mind, it seemed to me that my drinking problem was lifted right out of me. It wasn't like the water wagon business at all. This time I felt completely released of the desire, and I have not had a drink for months." Ebby didn't try to pressure or evangelize me, and pretty soon he left. For several days I went on drinking, but in no waking hour was the thought of my friend absent from my mind. I could not forget what he had said. In the kinship of common suffering, one alcoholic had been talking to another. My mood swings continued from rebellion against God to hope, and then back again. One day, while pretty maudlin, I got a great idea. I figured it was time I did some religious investigation on my own hook. Remembering that Sam Shoemaker's Calvary Church had a mission where Ebby's Oxford Group friends had lodged him, I thought I would go and see what they did down there. I left the subway at 4th Avenue and 23rd Street. It was a good long walk along 23rd Street, so I began stopping in bars. I spent most of the afternoon in the bars and forgot all about the mission. At nightfall, I found myself in excited conversation in a bar with a Finn named Alec. He said he had been a sailmaker and a fisherman in the old country. Somehow that word fisherman clicked. I thought again of the mission. Over there I would find fishers of men. Oddly enough, it seemed like a wonderful idea. I sold Alec on coming along, and soon we reeled in the front door of the mission. Tex Francisco, an ex-alky in charge, was right there to meet us. He not only ran the place, he proposed to run us out of it. This made us quite sore as we thought of our good intentions. Just then, Ebby turned up, grinning. He said, "What about a plate of beans?" After the food, Alec and I had slightly clearer heads. Ebby told us there would be a meeting in the mission pretty soon. Would we like to go? Certainly we would go. That's why we were there. The three of us were soon sitting on one of those hard wooden benches that filled the place. I had never seen a mission before, and I shivered a little as I looked at the derelict audience. There was a smell of sweat and alcohol. I could well imagine how much suffering was represented in this gathering. There were some hymns and prayers. Then Tex, the leader, exhorted us. "Only Jesus could save," he said. Somehow this statement did not jar me. Certain men got up and made testimonials. Numb as I was, I felt interest and excitement rising. Then came the call. Some men were starting forward to the rail. Unaccountably impelled, I started too, dragging Alec with me. Ebby reached for my coattails, but it was too late. I knelt among the shaking penitents. Maybe then and there, for the very first time, I was penitent too. Something touched me. I guess it was more than that. I was hit. I felt a wild impulse to talk. Jumping to my feet, I began. Afterward, I could never remember what I said. I only knew that I was really in earnest and that people seemed to pay attention. Ebby, who at first had been embarrassed to death, told me with relief that I had done all right and had given my life to God. Upstairs after the meeting, I saw the dormitory where the derelicts slept. I met a few who had made good recoveries. Some were living at the mission, working outside by day. Eagerly I listened to their stories. I sobered up very fast, and the dead weight on me seemed to go on lifting. With a qualm, I remembered Lois. I had not phoned her, and she would be worried. I must tell her all about this. It was good to hear her sigh of relief at the other end of the wire. Slowly and quite confidently, I made my way up 23rd Street to the subway. As I went down the stairs, it was startling to realize that I hadn't thought of looking in any of the bars. This was something new, very new. Had I, too, been released? Before going to bed, Lois and I had a long talk. There was hope in every word. Without an ounce of gin, I slept like a child. I was due for a terrible hangover the next morning, but I had almost none at all. Yet that small hangover was my undoing once more. I felt I would be more comfortable watching the sun come up if I had a drink. Just one or two, maybe. Saying nothing to Lois, I took a couple of board and followed them up with mouthwash. She noticed nothing, and I felt fine. After she left for work, the hangover got very troublesome again. This was to be the last one. Rationalizing as usual, I felt justified in tapering off. As always, of course, I tapered on instead of off, and at 6 o'clock, poor Lois found me upstairs on the bed, dead drunk. Yet I had seen some kind of light, and although I drank on for 3 days, I kept pondering that mission experience Sometimes it seemed real. Then again, I would brush it away, charging it off to an alcohol-fired imagination. On the morning of the third day, my wandering thoughts gathered into a sharp focus. I remember comparing myself to a cancer victim. If I had cancer, I would do anything to get well, would I not? Yes, anything whatever. Would I sit home and put cold cream on the affected parts? No, of course not. What would I do? I would head for the best physician in the business and beg him to destroy or cut away those consuming cells. I would have to depend on him, my God of medicine, to save me. My dependence would be absolute. For myself, I could do nothing. Alcoholism, not cancer, was my illness. But what was the difference? Was not alcoholism also a consumer of body and mind? Alcoholism took longer to do its killing, but the result was the same. So if there was a great physician who could cure the alcoholic sickness, I had better seek him now, at once. I had better find what my friend had found. Would I, like the cancer sufferer, do anything to get well? If getting well required me to pray at high noon in the public square with the other sufferers, would I swallow my pride and do that? Maybe I would. Meanwhile, though, I would go back to Towns Hospital, where Dr. Silkworth would sober me up again. Then I could look clear-eyed at Ebby's formula for sobriety. Perhaps I would not need an emotional conversion. Maybe a conservative doubter like me could get by without anything like that. Anyhow, I started for the hospital. Walking up Clinton Street to the subway, I fished 6 cents out of my pocket. A nickel would get me to the hospital. But hadn't I forgotten something? Here I was on my way to be cured. Typical alcoholic that I was, I figured I might as well be comfortable until the hospital took over. I stepped into a grocery store where I had a slim credit. I remember explaining to the clerk that I was an alcoholic on my way to be cured. Could I have 4 bottles of beer on the cuff? I drank 1 bottle on the street and another in the subway. My spirits rose as I offered the third to a passenger. He turned down my refreshment. So I drained that bottle on the station platform near the hospital. Holding the last bottle by the neck, I walked into Towns, where Dr. Silkworth met me in the hall. Now, in very high spirits, I waved the bottle and shouted, "At last, Doc, I've found something." Even through my haze, I could see the good old man's face fall. I now know how much he loved me. This fresh outburst really hurt him. I tried to explain the new thing I thought I had found. He looked at me, shaking his head, and after a while, he quietly said, "Well, my boy, isn't it time you went upstairs, went to bed?" I was not in too awful a condition. In 3 or 4 days, I was free of what little sedative they gave me, but I was very depressed. I was still choking on the God business. Bright and early one morning, friend Ebby showed up and stood in the doorway, smiling broadly. I didn't see what was so funny. Then I had a suspicion. Maybe this is the day he is going to evangelize me. Maybe he is going to pour on the sweetness and light. But no. He made me wait until I asked him. "Well," said I, "what is your neat little formula once more?" In perfectly good humor, he handed it out again. "You admit you are licked. You get honest with yourself. You talk it out with somebody else. You make restitution to the people you have harmed. You try to give of yourself without stint, with no demand for reward. And you pray to whatever God you think there is, even as an experiment." It was as simple and yet as mysterious as that. After some small talk, he was gone. My depression deepened unbearably, and finally it seemed to me as though I were at the very bottom of the pit. I still gagged badly on the notion of a power greater than myself, but finally, just for the moment, The last vestige of my proud obstinacy was crushed. All at once, I found myself crying out, "If there is a God, let him show himself. I am ready to do anything, anything." Suddenly, the room lit up with a great white light. I was caught up into an ecstasy which there are no words to describe. It seemed to me in the mind's eye that I was on a mountain and that a wind not of air but of spirit was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. Slowly the ecstasy subsided. I lay on the bed, but now for a time I was in another world, a new world of consciousness. All about me and through me, there was a wonderful feeling of presence. And I thought to myself, so this is the God of the preachers. A great peace stole over me, and I thought, no matter how wrong things seem to be, they are still all right. Things are all right with God and his world. Then, little by little, I began to be frightened. My modern education crawled back and said to me, "You are hallucinating. You had better get the doctor." Dr. Silkworth asked me a lot of questions. After a while, he said, "No, Bill, you are not crazy. There has been some basic psychological or spiritual event here. I've read about these things in the books. Sometimes spiritual experiences do release people from alcoholism." Immensely relieved, I fell again to wondering what actually had happened. Here is a footnote. Nearly every AA has a spiritual experience that quite transforms his outlook and attitudes. Ordinarily, such occurrences are gradual and may take place over periods of months or even years. A considerable number of AAs, including Bill, who have had the sudden variety of spiritual experience, see no great difference, so far as the practical result is concerned, between their quick illumination and the slower, more typical kinds of spiritual awakening. More light on this came the next day. It was Ebby, I think, who brought me a copy of William James' Varieties of Religious Experience. It was rather difficult reading for me, but I devoured it from cover to cover. Spiritual experiences, James thought, could have objective reality, almost like gifts from the blue. They could transform people. Some were sudden, brilliant illuminations. Others came on very gradually. Some flowed out of religious channels. Others did not. But nearly all had the great common denominators of pain, suffering, calamity. Complete hopelessness and deflation at depth were almost always required to make the recipient ready. The significance of all this burst upon me. Deflation at depth. Yes, that was it. Exactly that had happened to me. Dr. Carl Jung had told an Oxford group friend of Ebby's how hopeless his alcoholism was, and Dr. Silkworth had passed the same sentence upon me. Then Ebby, also an alcoholic, had handed me the identical dose. On Dr. Silkworth's say-so alone, maybe I would never have completely accepted the verdict, but when Ebby came along and one alcoholic began to talk to another, that clinched it. My thoughts began to race as I envisioned a chain reaction among alcoholics, one carrying this message and these principles to the next. More than I could ever want anything else, I now knew that I wanted to work with other alcoholics. As soon as I was discharged from the hospital, I associated myself with the Oxford groups. We worked at Sam Shoemaker's Calvary Mission and also at Towns Hospital. Ebby came to live with Lois and me in Brooklyn. I started out, after drunks, on jet propulsion. My sudden spiritual experience, however, had its disadvantages. I was soon heard to say that I was going to fix up all the drunks in the world, even though the batting average on them had been virtually nil for the last 5,000 years. The Oxford groupers had tried, had mostly failed, and were fed up. Sam Shoemaker, in fact, had just had a run of bad luck. He had housed a batch of drunks in an apartment near his church, and one of them, still resisting salvation, had peevishly thrown a shoe through a fine stained glass window in Sam's church. No wonder my Oxford group friends felt that I had better forget about alcoholics. But I was still mighty cocksure, and I ignored their advice. Mine was a kind of twin-engine power drive, consisting of one part of genuine spirituality and one part of my old desire to be a number one man. This posture didn't pan out well at all. At the end of 6 months, nobody had sobered up. And believe me, I had tried them by the score. They would clear up for a little while and then flop dismally. Naturally, the Oxford groupers became very cool indeed toward my drunk fixing. Lois, meanwhile, was still working in the department store, and folks were beginning to say, "Is this fellow Bill going to be a missionary for life? Why doesn't he go to work?" Even to me, this began to look like a good idea. I began to hang around Wall Street again, and through a chance acquaintance I had scraped up in a brokerage, I insinuated myself into a proxy row that involved control of a little machine tool company in Akron, Ohio. In May of 1935, a party of us went out to Akron, fighting for control of the company. I could already see myself as its new president. But when the chips were down, the other side had more proxies, and our side got licked. My newfound acquaintances were discouraged, and they left me in Akron's Mayflower Hotel with only about $10 in my pocket. They departed on Friday. On Saturday, Mother's Day Eve, I was pacing up and down the hotel lobby, wondering what I could do. The bar at one end of my beat was filling up rapidly. I could hear the familiar buzz of conversation in there. Down at the other end of the lobby, I found myself pausing before a church directory. Then I was seized with a thought. I am going to get drunk. Or no, maybe I won't get drunk. Maybe I'll just go into that bar and drink some ginger ale and scrape up an acquaintance. Then I panicked. That was really a gift. I had never panicked before at the threat of alcohol. Maybe this meant that my sanity had been restored. I remember that in trying to help other people, I had stayed sober myself. For the first time, I deeply realized it. I thought, you need another alcoholic to talk to. You need another alcoholic just as much as he needs you. Then followed a strange chain of consequences. Choosing at random from the church directory, I called up an Episcopal padre by the name of Walter Tunks, a great friend of AA to this day. In frantic eagerness, I poured out my tale to him. I asked if maybe he knew some people who could put me in touch with another alcoholic. I thought he might know some of the Oxford groupers around Akron. When the good man learned that I was an alcoholic looking for another alcoholic to work on, he at first apparently envisioned two people drunk instead of one. But he finally got the point and gave me a list of about 10 people who might be able to direct me. I immediately began calling them up. It was Saturday afternoon. People were not at home. Others were not interested and made excuses. The list quickly dwindled until it came down to one name at the very end. That name was Henrietta Seiberling. I had a vague recollection from my Wall Street days of meeting an elderly Mr. Seiberling, one-time founder and president of Goodyear Rubber. I could hardly imagine calling up his wife and telling her that I was a drunk from New York looking for another drunk to work on. So I went back downstairs and walked up and down the lobby some more. But something kept saying to me, you'd better call her. So I finally rang up. Unexpectedly, a young southern voice came over the wire, which turned out to be that of a Seiberling daughter-in-law. I explained that I was an alcoholic from the New York Oxford groups who needed to help another drunk in order to stay sober himself. Very quickly, she got the drift of what I was saying. She said, I'm no alcoholic, but I've had my difficulties. When you talk about spiritual matters, I think I understand. I know someone you might help. Won't you come out here right away? I live in the gatehouse of the Seiberling place. When I got there, I found a person of charm and understanding. She said she had worked through many a hard problem and had found her answers in the Oxford groups. She understood deep suffering. When I had told my story, she said, "I know just the man for you. He is a doctor. We all call him Dr. Bob. His wife, Anne, is a grand person. Bob has tried so hard. I know he wants to stop. He has tried medical cures. He has tried various religious approaches, including the Oxford groups. He has tried with all his will, but somehow he cannot seem to do it. So how would you like to talk with Dr. Bob and Anne?" Soon Anne S. was on the phone, A.A.'s much-loved Anne. Quickly, Henrietta told her about me, an alcoholic from New York who wanted to talk about his drinking problem. Could she and Dr. Bob come over? Anne said, "I'm sorry, Henrietta, I don't think we can make it today. Bob always makes a great fuss over me on Mother's Day. He has just come home bringing a big potted plant." What Anne didn't say was that the plant was on a table and that Bob was under the table, so potted that he couldn't get up. Henrietta said, "What about tomorrow? Why can't both of you come over to dinner?" Anne said they would try to make it. Next afternoon at 5 o'clock, that wonderful couple, Dr. Bob and Anne, stood at Henrietta's open door. This was the man who was to be my partner and founder of Akron's Group Number 1. With the remarkable Sister Ignatia, he was to care for 5,000 cases of alcoholism in the time when AA was still very young. This was the wonderful friend with whom I was never to have a hard word. This was Dr. Bob, AA's co-founder-to-be. But at 5 o'clock that Sunday afternoon, Bob did not look much like a founder. He was shaking badly. Uneasily, he told us that he could stay only about 15 minutes. Though embarrassed, he brightened a little when I said I thought he needed a drink. After dinner, which he did not eat, Henrietta discreetly put us off in her little library. There, Bob and I talked until 11 o'clock. Just before leaving for Akron, Dr. Silkworth had given me a great piece of advice. Without it, AA might never have been born. "Look, Bill," he had said, "you're having nothing but failure because you are preaching at these alcoholics. You are talking to them about the Oxford group precepts of being absolutely honest, absolutely pure, absolutely unselfish, and absolutely loving. This is a very big order. Then you top it off by harping on this mysterious spiritual experience of yours. No wonder they point their finger to their heads and go out and get drunk. Why don't you turn your strategy the other way around? Aren't you the very fellow who once showed me that book by the psychologist James, which says that deflation at great depth is the foundation of most spiritual experiences? Have you forgotten all about that? Have you also forgotten that Dr. Carl Jung in Zurich told a certain alcoholic, the one who later helped sober up your friend Ebby, that his only hope of salvation was a spiritual experience? No, Bill, you've got the cart before the horse. You've got to deflate these people first. So give them the medical business, and give it to them hard. Pour it right into them about the obsession that condemns them to drink and the physical sensitivity or allergy of the body that condemns them to go mad or die if they keep on drinking." Coming from another alcoholic, one alcoholic talking to another, maybe that will crack those tough egos deep down. Only then can you begin to try out your other medicine, the ethical principles you have picked up from the Oxford groups. Now, talking with Dr. Bob, I remembered all that Dr. Silkworth had said. So I went very slowly on the fireworks of religious experience. I just talked away about my own case until he got a good identification with me, until he began to say, "Yes, that's me. I'm like that." In turn, Dr. Bob talked to me about himself as he had never talked before. He, too, was a Vermonter. His father had been a stern but deeply respected judge in St. Johnsbury. Also, as in my case, drinking proclivities had shown up early. In fact, he had busted out of Dartmouth College for this reason. Somehow, he had wormed his way through medical school and internship in Chicago. Despite his drinking, he had shown a talented flair for surgery. After his marriage to Anne, they had settled in Akron, where, in due course, young Bob was born and a daughter, Sister Sue, was adopted. Dr. Bob, at the time of our first meeting, was 55, some 15 years older than I. He must have had an iron constitution. He said that all through the years his drinking had been practically continuous. When he got too jittery to operate or to see patients, he sedated himself heavily. When this recourse sometimes failed, he would steal away for a week or so to a drying out place so that he could start the same cycle all over again. In those rare moments when he got thoroughly sober, the insatiable craving for alcohol never let up. This was a physical phenomenon which bedeviled even his first years in AA, a time when only days and nights of carrying the message to other alcoholics could cause him to forget about it. Although this craving was hard to withstand, it doubtless created some part of the intense incentive and energy that went into forming Akron's Group Number One. Bob's spiritual release did not come easily. It was to be painfully slow. It always entailed the hardest kind of work and the sharpest vigilance. Yet he seemed to have no serious neurotic difficulties. As he often put it, "I just love my grog." By the time I met him, this compelling love had almost done him in. His surgical skill was still recognized, but few colleagues or patients dared to trust him. He had lost his post on the staff of Akron City Hospital and barely existed through a precarious and dwindling general practice. In debt up to his ears, he was only one jump ahead of the sheriff and his mortgage payments, and verged on a nervous crack-up, and their two children, of course, were greatly upset. Such was the payoff of 25 years of alcoholism. Hope was a word they had come to avoid. In our first conversation, I bore down heavily on the medical hopelessness of Dr. Bob's case, freely using Dr. Silkworth's words describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus allergy theme. Though Bob was a doctor, this was news to him, bad news. Always better versed in spiritual matters than I, he had paid little attention to that aspect of my story. Even though he could not make them work, he already knew what the spiritual answers were. What really did hit him hard was the medical business, the verdict of inevitable annihilation, and the fact that I was an alcoholic and knew what I was talking about from personal experience made the blow a shattering one. In Dr. Bob's story, as afterwards written for the AA book, and years later in his last full-length talk at Detroit, he made this point very clear. It was not any spiritual teaching of mine. Rather, it was those twin ogres of madness and death, the allergy plus the obsession, that triggered him into a new life. It was Dr. Silkworth's idea, confirmed by William James, that struck him at great depth. You see, our talk was a completely mutual thing. I had quit preaching. I knew that I needed this alcoholic as much as he needed me. This was it. And this mutual give and take is at the very heart of all of AA's 12-step work today. This was how to carry the message. The final missing link was located right there in my first talk with Dr. Bob. Unexpectedly, I got a little fresh financing from my New York business associates, so I stayed on in Akron that summer of 1935 to continue the proxy fight. Still worried about Dr. Bob, Anne invited me to come over and live with them at their home at 855 Ardmore Avenue. How well I remember our morning meditation when Anne would sit in the corner by the fireplace and read from the Bible, and then we would huddle together in stillness, awaiting inspiration and guidance.